lots of us approach the challenges of being ourselves by wanting to sort of find ways to exert more control over it. And not only is that, does that run into the problem that there's only so much control we can exert as finite humans, but also that we actually, if we think about it and experience it, wouldn't want to exert that much control. Time and again, it is the case that what we value the most in life seems to sort of happen to the degree that we don't control life.
Hi, hello. Welcome to Mary's Cup of Tea, the self-love podcast for women, though all self-lovers are welcome here. I'm Mary. I write and speak about self-love, and I'm best known for my book, The Gift of Self-Love, and I also host retreats for women. And this is the podcast that will inspire you to love yourself.
I try to refrain from speaking in superlatives and overusing words like best and only and ever, but Oliver Berkman, our guest today, is truly the only person to get the best ever productivity advice from. Why? Because it is rooted, it comes from a place of first cultivating a deep sense of self-acceptance. At least that's what I receive from his work. And if you're a longtime listener of this podcast, you know that I've been incessantly telling you about his book, this one specifically. It's called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. And it's essentially about facing your existential dread to then hopefully liberate yourself to do things that matter the most. And then his follow-up book to that is called Meditations for Mortals, 4 weeks to embrace your limitations and make time for what counts. So I freaked when Oliver agreed to be on this show. A lot of you who have listened to the other guest episodes probably are like, I don't think I've ever seen Mary interview a man on her podcast aside from her husband. And this is true. I mean, but Oliver just gets it. Like, he gets it and is going to make you feel equal parts heard and attacked. And also walk away with really actionable advice that's maybe disguised as like productivity advice, but to me really is advice for self-acceptance. In this episode, Oliver Berkman exposes why common time management hacks fail and how accepting your human finitude liberates you to be productive, not in a capitalistic sense, but in a meaningful way. Oliver talks to us about how to redefine productivity beyond endless to-do lists, unlock mental shifts that free you from perfectionism and anxiety and overwhelm, let go of the pressure to do it all and do it all perfectly. And I really hope you stick around to the end because this part's important. How do you care about the world's problems without succumbing to despair? Please enjoy. Without further ado, I'm so excited to bring to you Oliver Berkman on the Mary's Cup of Tea podcast. Hi, Oliver. Welcome to Mary's Cup of Tea.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I only have a glass of water, I'm afraid.
That's okay. It could be Oliver's cup of water if you ever start your own podcast.
Yeah, though it's not very on brand for a British person, but I don't drink a lot of tea, I have to confess.
Oh, wow. I feel like I already got such juicy content in the first couple seconds. Well, if you were a tea drinker, or perhaps you don't have to be, but proverbially speaking, what is your cup of tea, like something small that you've been delighting in lately?
Oh, what an interesting question. We live in a very rural part of Northern England, and it is lambing season here, which isn't all a happy story when you think about all the different stages of the process, perhaps. I mean, from the point of view of the lambs, but there is something absolutely extraordinary about being surrounded by these fields of sheep with their baby sheep. There's a real sort of playfulness to those young animals that is kind of really makes my sort of walks around the area more fun.
Lambing. I didn't even know what that was.
Well, lambing means that the lambs are being born, but a lot of them are destined for where lambs. Hey, here we are. We're talking about meat production within the first few minutes.
But also death and mortality, which is really what your work is about, like conquering existential dread in some way. And you lure people in by being like, productivity, time management. And then in the first couple of pages, you're like, let's talk about your mortality.
Yeah. I mean, I think ultimately the only reason that any of these questions of managing time and really any question in life, I think you could make the argument is only meaningful because we're finite, because we're mortal. If we lived forever, then the answer to the question, what should I do with today, would always be like, doesn't matter, right? Because there's always an infinity of other days to choose from. And it's because that's not the case that our lives have the meaning that they do.
Yeah. Sometimes we lose sight of that. And not only do we think we're infinite and invincible, but we also flagellate ourselves whenever we don't meet all the expectations. And I really, really want to get into that. But can I just shower you with love for just a second about how much your work means to me?
Happily. Yes, sure.
fine, if you insist. My longtime listeners know that I've been incessantly talking about 4,000 Weeks. When it first came out and I devoured it, I did a dedicated episode to it. I did call it Productivity for Self-Lovers, and it was largely inspired by Time Management for Mortals, that format. And, you know, I added some elements of self-compassion and hugely inspired by your work. Send it to all my friends who say that they're feeling overwhelmed. But something a little bit more interesting that I was thinking about many years ago, maybe 6 or 7, when I was living with my parents, one Saturday afternoon, my stepdad was planted on the couch, glued to a book. And my mom and I were like, this man does not read. And he proceeded to only talk about that book for weeks on end. He ordered 15 copies, gave it out to anybody who would listen, which ironically at the time was my then new boyfriend, my now husband. And we were all kind of like, what is this book that he's so into? It was The Antidote.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Happiness for People Who Hate Positive Thinking. And that was one of your first books, is that correct?
Yeah, right, yeah. Wow, that's extraordinary. My gratitude to your stepdad.
I didn't realize you were the same person when I read 4,000 Weeks. It all just came back to me. Well, let's define some terms first. Your newsletter, for example, is called The Imperfectionist. How did you come up with that? And what does imperfectionism mean to you?
I don't recall exactly how I came up with it. I think these things sort of, I'm sure you've had this experience, they sort of present themselves to your mind in a way that you don't necessarily know where they came from. But it was after that that I sort of began to flesh out what I call in the new book, what the approach that I call imperfectionism. And in some ways, this is just like a label, because you've got to have a label for these ideas. It makes them sort of easier to get one's head around. But I suppose I'm talking about the approach to life that begins from the idea that there will always be too much to do, that you will never do all the things you feel you ought to do or would like to do, that you'll never sort of feel fully confident about the future or like you're absolutely ready to begin new ventures in your life, right? All these different things that on some level we spend a lot of time trying to fight this evidence of our limitation. I guess I think of imperfectionism as the stance that sort of begins from that and says, well, actually, these are the facts. So what are we going to do from here? And I guess a big part of what I want to argue, we can talk about this, is that this is not a reason to despair or resign yourself. It's actually like the beginning of everything. It's so much easier to take action on the things that matter and to enjoy yourself while you're doing that when you're no longer sort of chasing this, or no longer so intensely anyway, chasing this future state of being on top of it all and doing everything perfectly that never seems to arrive.
I believe the last paragraph of your introduction is something along the lines of like, you're never going to get done everything that you want to do. You're never going to catch up. You're never going to get on top of it. And that is excellent news. And I hear your voice in my mind saying that. That is excellent news. Can you say that for me?
I think the phrase is, you know what? That's excellent news. And one of the remaining uses of italics that I was allowed to preserve after my editor suggested that I take out some of my compulsive use of italics. I really think it is excellent news, but I think it takes a couple of steps, I guess, to feel into why it is excellent news. There's a kind of a defeat that you do have to go through, a sense of like failure in a way, but a very specific kind that is the prelude to something much better, ultimately.
Before we talk about that, did you have like a personal breaking point or like a time period of your life where you realized like, fuck, none of these productivity hacks are working for me and I'm never going to reach my insane expectations of myself?
The way it works for me as a very sort of left-brainy, analytical, intellect first kind of person, is I have these kind of intellectual breakthroughs in a very sort of sudden way, but then it takes me like years to live differently as a result of anything, right? So it's not that I sort of saw things differently and then I was suddenly free of it all. In many ways, I'm still sort of struggle with some of this stuff today. One of the sort of big moments that I write about in 4,000 Weeks was when I was sitting on a bench in Prospect Park in Brooklyn, where we lived at the time. I was working as a journalist and I was on my way that morning to my workspace where I wrote. And I guess I just had even more deadlines than usual. I had the sense of like the anxiety that I was feeling about all the things I had to get through by the end of that week was even higher than usual. And I was doing what I always did, which was sort of compulsively cycle through, like, what techniques can I use to get through all this? Like, if I cancel anything social that I had planned and I get up an hour earlier and go to bed an hour later, will that do it? Will I get there by Friday afternoon? And I recall just very powerfully being struck by the words, oh, like, it's impossible. You're trying to do something here that isn't possible. I'd had that thought many times in the past, but it was sort of like, oh, this is impossible. What can I do about it? I'm such a loser. This was more like, oh, it's impossible. And it was kind of liberating, right? It was a weight off my shoulders because I just sort of suddenly realized, and as I say, many years to sort of properly live up to this, but I just sort of suddenly realized that just because I felt like there was a certain number of things that I ought to do in a certain amount of time, that it didn't follow that it was possible to do them. And this was just like, yeah, this was a big moment for me because first of all, it's like much harder to beat yourself up about something when you've really seen the impossibility of it. And secondly, because it was sort of, it enabled me then both that week and for, you know, thereafter to understand a bit more clearly that my job was to choose some things to do from this infinite or certainly bigger than impossible, you know, impossible amount. And it would always only be to choose some things to do. And that doesn't mean you can always choose the most fun ones. There are times in life when that's not how it works and all the rest. But just knowing that all I had to do was choose some things and that this was something that was within my capacities to do was a really significant moment for me.
I'm so grateful for Prospect Park in Brooklyn. Shout out. Because historically, I've defined my worth by two things. The first one was appearance, and the second one was productivity. And as I read your books and newsletters, the amount of parallels that my brain connects to that struggle with body image and that same kind of epiphany download that I had one day as I was going through another vicious restrict, binge, feel like a failure, hate myself, like that whole cycle. And then at one point being like, it's impossible. Like, I'm never going to be as skinny or perfect or look the way that I assume that I want in my head or that society says we need to be in order to deserve a sense of happiness, peace, confidence, love.
Yeah, no, I can really see how those parallels would shake out. It's for reasons of sexism, basically, I guess. That's not something that the specific context is not one that I'm personally have experience of, although it's not unheard of among men. But it's the same pattern can repeat itself in so many different domains. And there's this basic idea, the way I think of it anyway, tell me if this resonates, but like it's like the minimum acceptable thing that you deem you have to be able to do or to be just minimally okay and earn your right to exist is actually something that no human being could ever do. So like you're setting your minimum like above the maximum that a human can get to. And there are reasons why we do this. And, you know, it's, I don't think we should sort of beat ourselves up for beating ourselves up, but it's no way to live.
And even if at some point you go to the extremes and you get, I don't know, the pat on the back from a boss after hitting some heavy deadlines or In my case, I did these fitness competitions, won some trophies, and now I'm like, oh, well, I did it once, so now I have to do it again and again for the rest of my life.
Totally, right, yes. This is this idea associated with these kind of category of that psychologists call insecure overachievers, which is a lot of us, I guess, where, and I am very, very well acquainted with this thought, right, that like, as you say, successes just become more punishment because they just set the bar at the place that it's a new minimum now, right? It's like that's the new level which you can't be allowed to fall beneath next time. So it's really vicious, actually, because it just means that it sort of turns success into a kind of failure.
I heard Liz Gilbert talk about it, the author of Eat, Pray, Love, how paralyzing it was for her to absorb the success of that book and then movie starring Julia Roberts, and then, you know, just have this deep fear that she will never, ever be able to produce a work like that ever again. I think you've referenced that in your book. And whenever you write about insecure overachievers, I feel equal parts heard and attacked, because that phrase is just so, so me.
Equal parts heard and attacked is really what I'm going for. And, you know, I think people have often said to me, they think why writing is confronting. And I'm always a bit surprised because it's like, well, it's just me too, right? But I think I probably have written about that. I've mentioned Liz Gilbert many times in things I've written because she's so brilliant and so close to this kind of material and this outlook, you know, everything she's writing. But she wrote a book called Committed about marriage after Eat, Pray, Love. And there's an introduction to that book that sort of talks about how she ended up ripping up hundreds of pages because she'd been trying to write for the audience of millions who had read Eat, Pray, Love. And you can't do that kind of work when there are a million people in your head, all judging you as critically as possible because they're in your head.
How do you now, through the lens of perhaps imperfectionism, what you read about in 4,000 Weeks, how do you now, maybe, I don't know if it's define productivity or feel a sense of productivity for yourself personally? Like, do you even use that word to describe a day? Because when my husband and I meet at the end of a long day, I'll be like, how was your day? And the good answer, the way I know he had a good day, is if he looks at me and goes, productive. And then the bad answer will be not productive. And that's literally, I mean, I think we all, I don't know, is it a byproduct of late stage capitalism where if it's not productive, we all let it affect our self-esteem. But it's just wild how we attach it, productivity to goodness so, so closely.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think it does depend what you mean by the word. And I have experimented with all sorts of formulations. So sometimes I say meaningful productivity. There's a word that I come across from sort of therapy writings and Jungian therapy writings, especially, that is generative and generativity. And there's something interesting in that. Like, would you have a generative day? That'd be an interesting way to ask the question. And more, I just come back to very vague things like a feeling of aliveness or a feeling of vibrancy, or resonance is the word from the theorist Hartmut Rosa that I write about in the new book. And to me, that is bound up with some kind of productivity, some kind of action taking. I think there are reasons that I want to create stuff and do things in the world that are not all just insecure overachievement. And like, if I were to become completely fully integrated and relaxed and enlightened, then I would just stop doing things. In fact, I think in some ways that's kind of one of the points that I hope I'm communicating, is that like, you don't have to choose, I believe or hope, between peace of mind and serenity on the one hand and creative action on the other. But like, you can do both of these things. You don't have to do them anymore. You don't have to do the stuff anymore to sort of fill an inner void, but you do it because it's fun and good to do it, and because it's part of living to want to do that stuff. And there are people, I don't know your husband, but there are people who are naturally already in that space, right? They just love doing stuff. They're not actually doing it to kind of shore up an inner sense of inadequacy. And I'm always very admiring of them when I sense that I'm in their presence, right? It's just like, why would you not want to create things and connect people and form friendships with people? It's like, it's what being alive is about. So I think it's totally possible to sort of rescue some definition of productivity from that kind of Protestant work ethic, late stage capitalism, unless I produce more and more and more, I don't get to be justified in my existence kind of outlook.
Personally, out of all those phrasing, the one that I like in lieu of productivity that I wrote down, as soon as you said it, I'm like, that's the one for me, is creative action. I might also add like creative aligned action. I really like that. Before I ask you about resonance and further dig into what's an alternative to productivity, I must put my husband on blast and say the man loves errands. Like he gets lit up when he's running errands. And for me, it's draining.
I was going to, yeah, right.
It just goes to show how we all have different things that feel, I guess, generative, so to speak. And thus the more reason to kind of embrace our limitations or our various energy levels or for women, their cycles or.
Yeah. And build a life with somebody who enjoys doing errands. That seems like a good recipe. Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely.
So tell us about resonance and why that particular term resonated with you so deeply that it was one of the first passages in Meditations for Mortals.
I had been groping around at these ideas for a while when I encountered the work of Hartmut Rosa, who is a German social theorist. He's written a very, very big, quite readable, but big book called Resonance. The subtitle is A Sociology of Our Relationship to the World. And he's written a very tiny book, also very readable, called The Uncontrollability of the World. And they basically amount to making the same point. He's not so much talking about individual life as I am, but it's the same idea on a sort of societal level, that we sort of ceaselessly pursue a greater sense of control over things. We feel overwhelmed, when we feel like we don't know what we're doing or like we don't measure up or any of these things, what we want is to sort of be more in control of experience. And he makes the case that this is also true of societies, right? That the sort of natural, or in some sense, natural progress of societies is to exert ever more and more control over nature, over scientific knowledge, over the processes of life, health, education, all the rest of it. And yet that what happens when we achieve more control over our lives or over our societies is quite reliably that we lose what he calls resonance, the real sort of hard to specify kind of sense of vibrancy and aliveness. The kind of, I always think like, when you have one of those random days that you fall into that you weren't particularly expecting to be a great day, but you're hanging out with friends or family and it just sort of all comes together and it just feels like you're in the flow and everything. There's something going on there that is not going on at other times, especially when you're trying to sort of carry out a very specific and rigid set of steps. The reason that I find this also relevant to what I'm writing about is that I think that lots of us approach the challenges of being ourselves by wanting to sort of find ways to exert more control over it. And not only does that run into the problem that there's only so much control we can exert as finite humans, but also that we actually, if we think about it and experience it, wouldn't want to exert that much control. Time and again, it is the case that what we value the most in life seems to sort of happen to the degree that we don't control life. There are so many examples of this. I won't go on and on with this answer, but one way of thinking about it is like, if you just look back at your life to date and you think about anything that you're really happy about in terms of a career opportunity that came to pass or meeting someone who became an important friend, perhaps meeting a spouse, like the chances that came about because you sat down and set out a plan and carried it out and then the plan came out exactly as you planned is like vanishingly small. Again and again, it's like something happened that you wouldn't have predicted, and that's where the good thing came from. So even though we recognize that, like a lot of my life and my relationships and my marriage and my son and everything can all be traced in some way to the fact that I did a sort of one semester of a postgraduate degree in the United States after I graduated in the UK that was basically a disaster. I shouldn't have done it. If I'd had the right amount of control over my life that I thought I wanted, I'd have been like, okay, I can see ahead. I can see that this is academically disastrous for me. I'm not going to do it. Actually, if I hadn't done it, I wouldn't have been in a hall of residence, a dormitory next door to a guy who became a good friend. And then I inherited his social circle when I moved to America. La, 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 right? All these things follow, but they follow from things that are reflections of our lack of foresight and control over our lives. There's something quite important in that.
Yeah. And again, it's easy to forget that importance, but the serendipity and the butterfly effect, like it all happens by definition outside of your control.
It takes a lot of trust, you know, to sort of unclench your grasp over things, but it is repaid by a more engrossing life.
Totally. And even the small adventures. I'm thinking the New York Times published an op-ed, I think last October. I remember it because it came out. I was reading it as I was on my way to my first backpacking trip. And I'm a really good travel planner. I host retreats for a living. I plan all the trips for me and my friends. I'm better than ChatGPT, like truly, but also very neurotic about it. It'll take me many hours obsessively finding the best places, the best spots, the best views. And I do it all because I want to surprise the people that I'm traveling with the best experience. And at this point, the New York Times released an op-ed about reclaiming a sense of novelty, something along those lines. And it was so divine that I read it on my way to the backpacking trip because that was really scary for me. It was like 27 miles in just a couple of days. I've never gone on such a long hike before. And it resonated so much with me and the friends I was hiking with too, because like some of the best travel experiences are that little dive bar that you randomly came across, right? Or the time that you just find a joint somewhere. Sorry, that's like very, very personal. But somebody sells you something on the street and you're like, oh, okay, fine, whatever. And that turns into lots of giggles. And that novelty effect, I think, in day-to-day life could and should be reclaimed too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think what is interesting about that is that a lot of the time anyway, it's not that you need to sort of come up with a new plan to be a really serendipitous person, which very easily turns into a new kind of, right, perfectionistic, self-lacerating thing. It's just how life goes naturally when you allow yourself to just a little bit unclench your grip on the metaphorical steering wheel of it. And yeah, I really hope that I can convey this stuff in that spirit of like, not you need to change your life, but actually like what you would already be doing if you just let go of a bit of the self-criticism is like a lot of us anyway, doing a bunch of okay things when it comes to navigating life without the huge pressure of the idea that it must be different. The right way to do things must be different.
I shared on my Instagram my favorite planner the other day, this like little $6 thing, linked to it on Amazon. It was the most link clicks I've gotten on any post ever. And it was a little bit alarming and also just telling of how obsessed we are with not just productivity, but specifically to-do lists and finding the right format for to-do lists. So let's go back to the definition aspect that I haphazardly started with. How do you feel about to-do lists?
The first thing to say about all this stuff, right? Planners, productivity tricks, all the rest of it is like, I am not, as I hope I've made clear by now, coming at this from the perspective of someone who like never needed any of that junk. And I'm just sharing with the grateful populace my wonderfully serene way of living, right? It's like, I am a total junkie for all these things. And to this day, right? So you hold that up in front of the camera, I'm like, oh, what planner is that?
I'll send you the link. Yeah, I'll send you the link.
Cute. Yeah, right. Thanks. It's all to do with the spirit in which you encounter those things, right? There was a time when I related to all these things as if I thought the right one was going to save my life on some level. Now, at least to some extent, I'm able to just see it as a kind of fun, slightly eccentric hobby that I have. Like, I like things stationary and planners, fine. But it's not like that kind of, oh, is this going to be the system that finally makes me feel adequate as a person? So anyway, to-do lists. I don't have a problem with people keeping to-do lists. I'm sometimes presented as having this problem, but I don't think I've ever written that you should tear up your to-do lists. The essential problem with how a lot of people handle to-do lists is that they essentially, whether literally or not, but effectively, they ask themselves, okay, what needs doing today or this week or whatever the time scale is? And then they write down that list and then they haven't got a hope of getting to the end of it. It's going to get longer during as the day or the week elapses. And then you end feeling like you're a terrible failure because you didn't get through it. And in keeping with this whole philosophy I'm trying to outline, like, there is just no reason when you start that process. There is no reason why, because something feels to you like it needs doing today or this week, that you're going to have time to do it. These are just unrelated things. We have minds that can think of 100,000 things that need doing. And then we have bodies and attention and energy levels that are strictly limited in that regard. So if you start by saying, well, do I feel like I really need or ought to do this? You're automatically basically going to end up with a sort of feeling of mismatch and overwhelm. So there are a few different ways I like to sort of push back against that tendency. One of them that I know you know I've written about is just the idea of a done list, right? In parallel to the to-do list, keeping a list of things that you have completed as you complete them through the day. It's very, very satisfying to stop always only comparing what you've done to this kind of infinite amount of things that there are yet to do, because that's always effectively an infinite amount. And instead, also paying some attention to the fact that, like, you could have done nothing today, but instead, look, you did these kind of like 5, 10, 15 things. And then the other thing I've written about, which gets increasingly meaningful for me, I suppose, is understanding that lists are menus. Just that idea that, like, if there's always more that you could do and that would be useful to do than you're going to get to do in any given time period, then really your to-do list, by definition, is a list of things to pick from, which is what I mean by a menu, right? You go to a restaurant, nobody tries to get through. I hope they don't try to get through the whole list. The point about a restaurant menu is there's 40 things and you get to pick a couple of them, right? Whereas we tend to think of to-do lists as you've got to get through it all before you get to feel okay about yourself. But if the list of incoming tasks is effectively infinite, if you could fill a sort of 80-hour day with useful activity, if you had an 80-hour day, then by definition, actually, all lists are menus, really. We're all just picking the things we get to do. Of course, some of them are less enjoyable than delicious restaurant meals, and there are boring chores and tedious admin that you can't avoid, and some people have more of that they have to do than others. But you're still not needing to beat yourself up about, like, am I going to get through this list? Because the list is basically infinite for all intents and purposes. You may only have 50 items on your to-do list, but theoretically, first of all, you know you're only going to get through 8 of them in the course of a day anyway. But secondly, like, the real list, the list of all the things that it would be meaningful for you to do, goes on and on and on forever. So that's my feeling about to-do lists.
Sorry, seeing you get excited about this is making me really giddy. So it would be a disservice to say that this is the only thing I've implemented from your writing, but the done list and the menu, I really do that, especially on the days where, you know, where it's like noon and you're like, I've just been dicking around and haven't done a single important thing. That's when I'll, in this planner, write the things I actually did. As simple as I made breakfast this morning and then pet my dog and crossing them off. On that note, I think you've mentioned Cal Newport's Slow Productivity book. He also writes about, like, prioritizing the most meaningful things. And in that, he talks about, like, shut down your computer at the end of the day. Like, shut it down. Because a lot of us have these Macs that we just close and all the tabs are open. So the next morning, you open up to the same bullshit that you just beat yourself up over the day before, right? And so closing all those tabs, shutting down the computer, that's helped me. And then I've connected it to the done list, that if there's something on this lovely $6 planner that I didn't do, I put a squiggly through it. So my brain, like, I kind of know it's like different than like completely crossing it out. I didn't like do it, but I put a squiggly through it as in, like, I omitted the need to get it done in the first place, which is how you kind of write about email. If somebody's like very backed up with email, you know, you could just delete all your emails.
Yes, right. I mean, yes, or not, depending on your situation. But yes, in theory, you definitely could. I like your distinction between doing it, and doing it by putting a squiggly line through it. But it's really helpful to use any kind of system or method that helps you remember that, like, as some famous quote, I forget who said it, has it, but like, the problem is not that we don't have enough time to do all the things we need to do, it's that we feel the need to do more things than we have time for. And that ultimately is how it has to be that way round for humans who live in reality, right? There's no point, it's meaningless ultimately to say that you have to do more than you can do in the course of a day. That just doesn't make sense.
When I was in my late teens, I went on this atheist, quickly turned into nihilist journey, and one thing that I really remember from that phase of my life is reading somewhere that time is the one God that we all worship.
I like that phrase. Yeah.
Hey, self-lover, sorry to interrupt, but do you have my self-love playlist? There's over 300, if not 400 songs on it that are so fun and uplifting and empowering, and I think will really be perfect for when you're getting ready, trying to hype yourself up, dealing with a bad body image day, or anytime you just want a little boost of self-love, these tracks will do it for you. So head to maryscupoftea.com/playlist to get it, and know that I am dancing and jamming with you from afar. Cheers. Those are the few things that I've been able to implement, but one that I still struggle with, but love in theory, is the 70% rule. Could you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote about this in my newsletter quite recently, and that is proof that it's, you know, that shows that it's something I'm still sort of feeling my way around. I don't share things in the newsletter when I just thought of them, but I often do share things that I'm, you know, only spent a few weeks experimenting with. On some level, I'd been experimenting with this for a lot longer than that, but it sort of clicked into focus for me recently. And basically the 70% rule, I don't know what rule means in these contexts, but the idea is that if you feel sort of 70% confident that a decision is the right decision, 70% happy with something that you're planning to release into the world, publish or whatever, 70% confident that an action you're planning to take is action that you want to take, like make that the threshold for action. Get into the habit of moving forward at 70% confidence, basically. I discovered after I'd started writing about this that I'm not the first person to come up with it in this context, but there is something very powerful to me anyway about that particular level for a perfectionist, because it is most of the way there, right? 70% is most of the way there, but it's a real chunk not there, right? Like 30% is real. I'm not saying like when you're 95% certain or something, which is just an invitation to more perfectionism. And the thing I was trying to convey in that newsletter was, and this is a feeling that comes up a lot with what I write, I find, like, I'm not just saying like it's okay, you have permission to move forward at 70%. I'm not just sort of, I am hopefully conveying a sense of sort of forgiveness, but that's not the main thing. The main thing is like, can you see that this is actually a kind of muscular training? You're actually sort of building a skill, which is the skill of moving forward in the presence of anxiety or in the presence of self-criticism. So for the kind of person who thinks of themselves as a high achiever and who loves productivity techniques or who has a lot of fitness goals and runs marathons, like this is actually, can you think of it not as pushing back against that part of your personality and trying to get rid of the part of you that likes to achieve things, but can you think of this as the thing that you're going to try to achieve next, right? The sort of, I'm going to become sufficiently sort of mentally strong, I suppose, to be able to do this. And I'm going to, and every time I manage to do this, to like move forward at 70%, I'm going to like be able to congratulate myself for reaching a new height. So I'm trying to convey the idea that it's almost like, as I said in the newsletter, I know it doesn't make mathematical sense, but I'm almost trying to say that 70% is better than 100%. Because apart from the fact that you'll never reach 100%, even if you sort of do in certain contexts every so often, all you're doing then is reinforcing the idea that things have got to be 100% for you to take action. And so it takes a kind of guts, right, to move forward at 70%. And I practice this, but I don't find it easy a lot of the time. I still feel the, you know, when I publish a newsletter or send off a manuscript or something, I'm not thinking like, yeah, this is brilliant and I completely nailed it. But I am changing from thinking like, oh, this is rubbish, I haven't got it right, but I've just got to do it and then feel bad about it, to sort of, no, I think this is good enough.
Yeah, training yourself to accept good enough is kind of one way to, what you said earlier, release the grip and the compulsive control that we try to have on our lives.
Yeah, and very quickly, if it's in the context of sort of putting work out into the world, for example, very quickly you start to get feedback, which you wouldn't get if you were just sitting on the thing forever, right? And that's when you realize that like either you're good enough is really good because people love it, or, you know, sometimes people love it, sometimes people hate it. which just should tell you that, like, you don't have a clue what counts from their point of view, and nor is it really your problem on some level. So when I was writing columns for the Guardian newspaper as well, this would happen all the time, that, like, if I was proud of some piece, it would probably vanish without trace. And if I thought something was awful, but I just had to get something out there because the deadline had come, someone would tell me it was the best thing they'd ever read from me. So it's useful to remember that nobody knows anything. And that sort of feedback enables you to develop more trust in yourself and in the process of moving forward at 70%.
Mm-hmm. I can totally see that. It reminds me of how somehow on Saturdays, usually I take the Sabbath and I try not to work on Saturdays, but if my husband is, like, mowing the lawn or something, I'll pop open my computer and I'll know that I probably have like 30 minutes to maybe take a couple things off my plate. Somehow those 30 minutes, not only do I get a lot done, but they feel so good. Like, they feel so good. It felt like I really prioritized because it's like Saturday, so it has to be worthwhile for me to, like, take time on a Saturday to address this thing. It feels good because I know there's, like, an end in sight and I'm going to enjoy the rest of my day. It feels good because I know it's Saturday and I'm not really obligated to work anyway, so this is, like, bonus. And I'm like, wow, why can't I have this approach and this mindset on, like, a Wednesday? But somehow my brain is like 9 to 5. And if you're not, like, planted at your desk for those hours, which is why the recent studies, and I think you mentioned them in your book, like, about how we really only have a few hours in us of, like, decent work. Like, our brains are not accustomed to 8 hours of, especially, like, brain-focused activity.
Yeah, no, and I it's fascinating that you mentioned the idea of Sabbath in that context, because I've written a bit about this and find it very powerful myself, right? I mean, you've got a whole different spin on it here, which is kind of then, like, doing work within the Sabbath, which is kind of super interesting. But in a sense, that is still in keeping with it, right? Because what I love so much about the idea of the idea of Sabbath is that the reason that you stop on a Friday night or a Saturday night, depending on your religion, is not because you've done everything, but because it's time to stop. And if you don't stop now to just receive life for a day, you're never going
to
do it.
And you'll go to hell and be subject to eternal damnation.
Possibly. There's also that, right? Yeah, exactly. But so I quote Judith Shulevitz in 4,000 Weeks talking about, like, you know, the reason that the Jewish Sabbath traditionally has, like, sort of thousands of rules and very detailed rules that the most of us are supposed to follow is a reflection of the fact that, like, it isn't easy to stop. You really need to, like, be told again and again and again and in great detail how you're going to stop, because the natural momentum would just be to keep going until it was all done. If that's quite established in your life and you have that sense on that one day a week of being released from the sort of tyranny of obligation to work, then I'm not sure it necessarily is such a bad thing if you then decide to do half an hour, right, in that spirit. But yes, it must lead to that feeling of, like, well, why can't it be like this all the time? And on some level, right, it sort of can. Like, it's always the case that at the end of the day, it will be time to stop because it's the end of the day, not because you've done everything. So the idea that is enshrined in that notion of, like, it's Friday night, stop regardless, is kind of true of every arbitrary time period in the week, right? When your working day is up, you're going to stop. Because if you keep going until everything's done, you'll never stop.
You'll never stop. Yeah, and a lot of us kind of never stop or never feel like we stop.
Right. Because we think one day we're going to get to that place that when there's nothing left to do, which would be terrible, actually. But yeah, right. You won't get there and you wouldn't want to get there if you could.
You're going to die with a to-do list. And that's excellent news. Oliver, I know we're coming up on capital T time, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask this one big question. We can go as deep as you're comfortable, but what do you say to someone, or what's your advice for those of us who feel overwhelmed by all the world's problems, the chaos in our socio-political climate, children dying, like these big, heavy things that we're faced with in the news and on social media that we can't escape. And even though we're not to blame, we feel morally responsible for caring about these issues, even if we're not actually, like, doing anything specific to help the cause. So what do we do here? Like, how do we cope?
I don't have one answer that will neatly tie a bow on it all, but just a few quick thoughts. I mean, And assuming that we're talking here about and that we're talking to the kind of people who are a bit prone to sort of beat themselves up for not doing more, feel very, very anxious about it and feel that they wish they could do things to make their anxiety go away, but also to help others more. I think it's firstly very useful to remember that this sort of state of total uncertainty has been overwhelmingly the norm for humans throughout history. It is not actually new that it feels like everything is teetering on a knife edge. I don't think that makes it okay that it feels that way, but there's some solace in the idea that many, many generations of humans, until very recently at least, you know, that was just the absolutely normal state of life. And then I think, you know, it's really important also to understand that to make the most difference, having a sort of appreciation for your own finite capacities and attention and energy is really important. Social media presentation of news especially encourages us to sort of feel like we ought to do something about everything, but then leads us into ways of acting that don't really do anything, and doom scrolling and all the rest of it. In some very subtle way, it feels like an action. It feels like you're not just watching, you're sort of participating, even just refreshing, drag down to refresh, but certainly commenting and sharing and all that can very easily come to feel like something much more effective than it is. And so I would say two quick things. Like, one is never forget that if you do 10 minutes of stuff in a day or an hour a week that really makes a difference, or that could make a difference, that contributes to in some way or another making the world a better place, you've done more than somebody who spent 12 hours a day doom scrolling. Even if you spend the whole of the rest of your time just like pleasing yourself, having fun, forgetting about it, like, you've done more. So like, be the kind of person who does a little bit in reality, instead of the kind of person it's all too easy to be, who sort of emotes about it all the time and kind of doesn't do anything to help. And then I think, especially when these sort of things feel so all-encompassing and it feels like it's our lives, it's not just like far-off tragedies that we're trying to help, it's like it's right here at home, I think it's really important to remember that a big part of this is to do with like how, not just like what you campaign for or what you vote for or what you argue for on social media, but it's just like how you are in the world. And so one of the things that resonated with me a lot after the presidential election in the US just gone, and the sort of sense of this like constant kind of living too far inside the brains of people that I didn't want to be inside the brains of, was it's just like, there's something important here about just like looking people in the eye and having conversations in your neighborhood and being, trying to remember a little bit more to be the kind of person you'd like the world to be full of, rather than only thinking of this as something to sort of protest for, demonstrate for, advocate for. That's important, but like, we can sort of be the things that we, well, be the change, I guess, is the cliche, isn't it, right? But it's like, you can make a very big difference just by showing up in a certain way instead of another way.
That is really helpful, and I think we can never have too many of those reminders. I frequently think about studies on empathy. Something about like empathy at heightened levels makes us take less action, because empathy, kind of like what you said about like refresh, like comment, it makes us feel like we did something just because we felt something. But then that actually gets so overwhelming that we don't end up making any kind of positive dent in the world that we kind of feel like we do in our minds.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for, this has been such a big honor. Thank you for your time and agreeing to do this and showering us with your wisdom. It's much, much, much appreciated.
I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.